Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Amy, editor at ExchangeWire and your host for today. I'm delighted to welcome our guest, Chris Andrews, head of marketing technology at Miroma Founders Network. Welcome, Chris. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on. All good, thank you. Yeah, it's nice Thursday, nice warm Thursday here. So hopefully, all good.
Yeah, nice and warm here as well. Yeah, looking forward to our discussion. Absolutely. We're also joined by our research lead, Matt. How are you today?
I'm very well, Amy. Few technical issues on my side, which means my face has disappeared from the recording. But thankfully for a podcast, it's no real shame.
Yeah, shouldn't be too much disruption with that. So today we'll be looking at OpenAI's decision to launch a web browser, a study by the IPA in collaboration with the FT, which looks at trust as a business driver, as well as many ad agencies coming together to call for a total ban on fossil fuel advertising. So let's go into our first story. OpenAI is on the brink of releasing an AI-powered web browser, according to sources speaking to Reuters. The AI browser, which is due to be released in the coming weeks, could mount a challenge to the long-held dominance of the web browsing market by Google's Chrome, itself currently under heavy antitrust scrutiny. So, Chris, I'll go to you first on this one. Do you think this is a good move by OpenAI?
Yeah, I think it's been in the post for a while, right? It's an interesting one. I'm not sure it's a better or worse move than maybe taking some advantage of Google's sort of antitrust troubles and seeing what they can pick up in the post-DOJ fire sale. Might be cheaper than Johnny Ive and his mysterious hardware company. Probably take the over on that one. But it's definitely been in the post, like I say. They're obviously trying to compete to be the operating system, the front page of the web, whatever you want to kind of phrase that. I think to do that, you need to credibly own the architecture and as much of the touch points as possible. Google have done a sort of phenomenal job of that over the years in terms of how they've sort of asserted their dominance. They've got, 70% of the global browser market. They've got about 25% share of the email market, about two-thirds of the operating system globally. So they are entrenched. They've obviously asserted their dominance in that way. Obviously, Apple are probably the only ones that really kind of compete with them as the great monopolists, really, of the internet era in how that covers. So OpenAI do have a big job of that. But I think it's an interesting one for them to, it's the natural evolution for that in terms of their next move. And if they want to be kind of part of the architecture, then this seems to be the direction of travel for sure.
Great. And how scared do you think Google should be about the new browser?
I mean, I think it goes back to what I said there about, whether they get smashed apart by the DOJ or not. Like, are they going to have to divest Chrome? Are they going to have to divest? What are they going to have to divest? If it's Ad Manager, then fair enough. Maybe they might think they're kind of preparing for that eventuality. But if they're continuing to lose sort of different elements of that over time, then that's going to be a real problem. And while, talked about that potentially being unprecedented in terms of what they might need to be able to do, they've done a phenomenal, unprecedented job of generating scale, right? They've got to however many 100 million users quicker than any tech company in history. Obviously, saw how they have Google Plus, but obviously, this is slightly different. We've probably all seen the chart from investment firm Kochi a couple of weeks ago. It's about 3 weeks ago, so it should be cycling back around on LinkedIn now about how sustained use of ChatGPT correlates to about an 8% drop in Google page views and use over a couple of years. And if that's going to be the case, obviously, it feels like quite a little bit, but, some of the estimates, I've sort of taken this from Zimzar's exponential view, and this is where sort of some of the stuff comes from, is actually if that can potentially scale up to 20% of their overall kind of revenues kind of being eaten into, which is still huge, right? But 20%, no one can survive a 20% revenue drop overall, really, or not survive. They can survive it, but it's going to be a real struggle. And it sort of speaks to that shift. Now, if they can't own that shift in the market and they can't own that shift in how that moves and how that, where that direction probably is going to be, then they risk maybe becoming irrelevant. It's why you see a lot of funds and firms talking about going maybe moving away from Alphabet as a kind of growing entity over the next 5-10 years or so because they don't think they're responding to these queries. So if OpenAI encroach onto that turf and take sufficient market share, then it's gonna be a real struggle.
Yeah, this could make a big impact to their business. Matt, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think obviously I agree with Chris in that it's a, you know, makes perfect sense for OpenAI as a business to bring out a web browser, particularly as it seeks to maintain its ridiculous momentum in terms of funding. And obviously it's got rival AI platforms that are doing the same in terms of bringing out browsers. So yeah, makes perfect sense for them. In terms of Google, I think earlier on in the whole generative AI race, they were definitely caught a little bit napping, but I don't think they'll be as concerned in terms of the browser side of things as you may otherwise think. In terms of like the core web browsing experience, what is it? It's entering URLs to go to a specific platform, which is kind of sewn up. You know, I don't need a new browser to take me to bbc.co.uk/sport, for example. For search, as Chris said, Google's already the incumbent and they're increasingly adding more and more AI controls on there. So again, it's going to be difficult to get them out of that entrenched market position. In terms of actions, I'd say based on a specific platform, like do something in ChatGPT or watch a video on YouTube, I think that's where AI is leaning a bit more towards in. But at the moment, I'm only seeing edge cases rather than a real game changer to the web browsing experience. I read recently a kind of ridiculous puff piece review of Perplexity's Comet browser, which is only available at, you know, the $200 price point. And under the, you know, frankly ridiculous headline of Comet unlocks the internet, the author demonstrates how it used the AI assistant functionality to try and book a table at a steak restaurant using the prompt, "I'd like to go for a meal next Thursday in Seven Dials at the Hawksmoor restaurant at 8 p.m. Now, bearing in mind that that restaurant in, you know, specifically has a really easy to use drop down menu, you can book a table in about 3 or 4 clicks. And there was a screenshot on that review which showed sort of the process the AI model was going through. And it was, "I can see the booking modal has opened and is showing the available time slots for Seven Dials. So far, so good. I can see the 8 p.m. time slot is available. Now I need to identify the right node to click on the 8 p.m. slot." I mean, obviously you can just do a click. And clearly it gets stuck here because it then goes, "Let me try more, a more direct approach." So it couldn't even do what, you know, any other user could do. Well, most users can do in a few clicks. That's not, to me, unlocking the internet. That's just chugging through a ridiculous amount of processing power to do something the majority can do. Obviously, yes, there are use cases, and I'm thinking, you know, people with you know, accessibility issues, those who are unfamiliar with using booking forms. I think, you know, if you were booking a restaurant in, say, a foreign country, extremely useful. But to me, it's not a groundbreaking game changer that I need to pay $200 for.
Yeah, those are some interesting points there. And looking at the topic a bit more broadly now, what could change about advertising models in AI-powered browsers versus the traditional web browsing experience? Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, and I think to sort of expand on Matt's point there, which is yeah, really obviously good demonstration of a weakish use case. You can sort of see the logic of it, but actually the thing that kind of takes resource and just pushes it and makes it less, you know, less useful and more time wasting, less efficient overall. I mean, I had a sort of recent example, and I think it sort of speaks to some of the sort of modeled in the AI powered browser versus sort of traditional web experience. Is I sort of decided out of sort of personal professional curiosity, I'm, you know, at the kind of point in my life where, you know, I've got a 9-month-old baby, maybe the spare tire's getting a little bit bigger, I need to maybe get a little bit of a better bike to do my commute. So I'm like, well, actually, right, let's test this kind of what it is, and let's give them a bit of an understanding about what that might look like through AI. So set my parameters at Claude to pay 20 a month for, go, here's, you know, here's the parameters I'm looking for. I'm looking for a lighter bike. I'm this high, this tall, this heavy, whatever, all these kind of different parameters, load those kind of in. I've done a little bit of research before to kind of not prejudge the results. And essentially when you go, okay, what does that look like? Give me some examples right there. Go and search the web, do the kind of deep research and stuff like that. And it goes away and it will go on to, you know, your bike radar, your road CC, cycling. It's all these titles that kind of rely on these physical testing, deep domain knowledge, relationship with their suppliers, with their community, all these kind of different things. They're funded by advertising, affiliate models, all the kind of data bits that they want to do there. Now, I don't know what they've got on the back end in terms of how they're being kind of, you know, monetized and compensated for that, but it's scandalous information. It's giving me this thing. It's giving me this information back, and then they're getting nothing out of it. They're not getting anything from my affiliate, you know, my affiliate link. They're not getting anything in post view attribution. Not getting anything there whatsoever. So they've basically got full extraction of the value. I've got full extraction of the value. They've got no benefit other than me maybe mentioning their names in this podcast, right? So obviously they're going to get some of that. Obviously, it talks about the Cloudflare cost per crawl model, which we've been talked about last week, which might be a bit of compensation for them. But actually, in terms of an advertising model, you sort of start thinking in that use case or in the use case that Matt sort of talks about, how do you then find alternative ways of monetizing that? If you've got a cost per core model, for example, do you then go down the route of, well, we'll make this ad-funded content that someone's paid for, this bike brand has paid for, free to call, and that can be queried by the LLMs and stuff like that. And actually, we've got a really high premium on our particular content, which means we can't then extract that. Which again might be directionally where that kind of goes. Then obviously you go down the road of, you know, agentic and the theory of, and deliberately calling a theory of, kind of agentic and marketing to agents. It would be absolutely ludicrous if I bought a bike without sitting on it, riding it, testing all those kind of different things. But then you go, well, actually, what extent do you kind of go down the road of, you know, how does that apply to the weekly shop, for example, if I'm delegating that? And actually, because it's quite open to gaming, it probably does then conversely make it quite a viable revenue model for the people that are building these revenue models, right? So, you know, if you go for that lower ticket item, if I'm doing my weekly shop, it's the brand preference and the toothpaste style, for example, is a little bit different. If I then choose, I know I choose a particular brand of every time and whatever that might be, actually, is it then going to be overwriting that in my brand preference? Is it going, well, actually, we're going to go with this particular one because they bid more for it, bid more to be in this slot within this. So actually, if you're then taking the auction dynamics, which has been an incredibly efficient way and incredibly scalable way of basically underpinning the ad market for the last, 15, 20 years, certainly in a digitally traded sense, if those mechanics that apply to that, you can see how that might start to butt up maybe against, if you're going right to the extreme, the maximalist case there, it might start to butt up against a particular experience. Because we'd only take 2 weeks of like milk teeth appearing in my basket instead of Colgate to me to go, this is useless, to Matt's point about the horse more use case, right?
Yeah. Matt, do you have any thoughts there about what could change?
Yeah, I think we're kind of in that theoretical stage where everything could change, but no one's really sure how it will. Like, yeah, take sponsored listings as just one example in terms of that search piece. I think people would be very irked if, you know, you went to your AI-powered browser, wanted to do a A to B search of find me the cheapest flight to XYZ. If it was usurped by a high price alternative just because they sponsored it, I think that would, you know, piss people off a lot more than currently, you know, you go into search and it's just the top listing, but you can scroll down. Similarly, in terms of that restaurant case again, if it's the best steak restaurant in Farringdon and they recommend one other than the best reviewed, or one, you know, a couple of stars less than the best reviewed, that would obviously miff the user, which makes you think contextually adjacent ads may come to the fore more. You know, for example, if you're searching a flight to a hot country, you may get ads in a sidebar, you know, from clothing companies promoting summer outfits. But again, it's kind of in that theoretical stage, and it'll be interesting to see how that developed. To Chris's points in terms of the cost per crawl monetization, obviously you've got that Cloudflare model, but also you've got the LLM content ingest initiative from IAB Tech Lab, which is really exciting. Because I think, you know, regardless of how the advertising models shape up going forward, I think we can all agree that publishers, particularly in that mid to long tail, they're not being properly compensated at the moment for AI traffic. And obviously work needs to be done to make sure that's done, because that's obviously underpinning all the information that you're able to get from those AI-based searches.
Yeah, definitely. It's so important that those publishers get remunerated properly. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how everything develops within the space. So now moving on to our second story, which looks at a study released by the IPA and the Financial Times. It finds that trust is a core strategic asset which has a direct impact on profit, customer acquisition, and long-term brand success. The global study, which features insights from over 750 B2B decision makers, found that companies which measure customer trust as a broad level KPI were 3 times more likely to report stronger profits than those which do not. Chris, how should companies approach measuring and subsequently improving levels of consumer trust?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. And we're going to briefly slip into sales pitch, which is saying, preface this, my colleague Toby Strange would be very disappointed if I don't mention it. Sort of, he brought this Rachel Bossman quote to my attention, but we sort of center ourselves around trust being a confident relationship with the unknown, which again, the unknown is kind of a really important part of that, but it's actually a really core pillar about how we work with brands here. I remember our founders network in terms of helping brands grow with confidence. So in terms of, obviously, we've demonstrated that by delivering consistent growth. We've delivered that by, you know, deep relationships with our clients in the area that we were as Weight the Bear previously. We've recently rebranded as Miramar Founders Network, as we've taken some investment from Founders Forum Group. And they've obviously got the credibility, the trust to kind of build around, you know, they've scaled many unicorn businesses and had that within their portfolio. So that obviously, you know, it's about doing it credibly. And I think the research from the FT and the IPA really illustrates that quite nicely, because obviously, as you mentioned there, in terms of like the level of the volume of, you know, profit that's kind of likely to come out of that, it's only really one in five surveys that have it as such a KPI, because it's quite nebulous and it's quite difficult to measure. So actually you need to kind of, you know, obviously there's things like NPS, customer feedback, brand surveys, all those kind of different things that will do that. The brands that credibly take the time to get customer feedback, to take it on board, to listen, to interact, to iterate it within their frameworks, to really kind of do that, not as a lip service thing, but actually to really ingest it on board it within their product, within their flow. I think it's been demonstrated in a really bad way this week from WeTransfer, who have spent like absolutely forever building up this kind of reputation as the simple, credible, secure product in terms of getting things from A to B. If you need big files, it's absolutely fine. There's a degree of credibility built into that. Obviously, at enterprise level, sometimes it's not used, but essentially they've nurtured that positive relationship. They've really talked to themselves about creators and stuff like that. It's like, no, the data is safe with us. It's completely secure. And then that's been completely undone by this bit of kind of obscure legalese that sat within their terms and conditions, which everyone subscribes to, saying they retain rights or insinuates they return rights, or say it's denied, to train data, to train their machine learning models on the data contained within WeTransfer transfers. Like, so that's going to take forever to recover from with their existing cohort of users. But then if someone goes, oh, is WeTransfer secure? Someone does that search or whatever like that, that all is going to come up with those news stories about like, well, actually you're trading this and trading that sort of thing. So it's, I think they've done this and they've obviously worked to do that, and they've actually undone it quite quickly, or potentially undone it quite quickly. So actually, in terms of improving it, when you talk about improving trust overall, it's about actually how you define the playing fields that you deserve to be trusted on and acting authentically, credibly. And that is right down to your terms and conditions, as well as how you interface with customers, the kind of thing. And obviously, as the research talks about as well, is there's the borrowed credibility of the existing channels and all those kind of different channels that you know, if you can operate in. Obviously, understandably, the Financial Times being one of them and part of that. But actually, it's, you know, it's borrowing the credit. Thinkbox done a load of great work on it as it relates to TV, right? In terms of like, well, actually, if you are appearing alongside brands that have the resources, the means, the capacity to do this, you act and you feel like a bigger brand. It's the story that the out-of-home industry has been telling for ages and done so very successfully. So I think that's kind of how that would scale. And I think also, just again, to preface what we've obviously talked about as well, with is how much human in the loop is going to come, right, over the next few years. Is there going to be elements of, I trust this more because a human has demonstrably been involved in this, or actually you seed your content to AI, your social posting looks like slop, your creative, your content out there looks like it's just been generated by this. You don't trust me enough. You don't have enough faith in me as a customer to interrogate and interact your business in that way. They're right to trust you. So there's all those kind of different things in terms of how they show up across the board that can build and also damage that trust.
Yeah, those are some good points. And yeah, like you showed there with the example, trust can be very easily eroded quite quickly. Matt, what are your thoughts? How should companies approach improving levels of consumer trust? What do you think?
I completely agree with Chris, and you have to walk the walk. You can't just talk the talk and, you know, act like a trustworthy brand, but hide things away in terms and conditions that can ultimately break that trust. And in terms of obviously the measurement and metric side of things, yes, you can obviously dive deep into as many metrics as possible. You know, you can look at tracking your sales versus complaint ratios and things like that. But if you're not maintaining that meaningful dialogue with your consumers and actually acting on what you're trying to do in terms of building up a trustworthy brand, then, you know, it's all going to be for nothing. What I would do is encourage every brand and agency to read upon the study and act upon it, in terms of particularly the media context. You know, we've got, in terms of some of the stats there, 60% of respondents, which actually goes up to 70% of those under 45, more likely to trust a brand if its ads appear in gatekeeper media, such as business news brands, rather than those with user-generated content. And obviously recently, you know, in terms of the dissolvement of GARM, you had all the stories in terms of, for example, Unilever spending less than 2% of its total advertising budgets on online news. Online news is really trustworthy. It's seen as really trustworthy by users. This is just one of many, many studies that has just demonstrated that. And I think, to kind of preempt one of the following questions, you've really got to start funding that news media and putting your brand out there in terms of those trusted media sources. Yes, user-generated content and social networks, etc., they have a place in the advertising model, but also you've really got to start putting your brand in, you know, if you can fully back your brand in terms of walking that walk in trust, in terms of trust, put yourself out and show yourself how trustworthy you are by appearing in these really, you know, trusted news media environments.
Yeah, definitely. So on that note, Matt, why do you think we're continuing to see underinvestment in news media advertising?
So I think it's in terms of, you know, going to the big UGC platforms, you know, your YouTubes, your Facebooks, your Instagrams of the world. Obviously, there's scale, you know, in terms of the number of users, and obviously because they're more closed loop environments, it just makes it easier in terms of that reporting piece, which is obviously hugely important to brands and agencies. There's also more custom targeting options. I think there's also some misconceptions around quality as well. Obviously, in terms of display, you've got made for advertising sites being rightfully maligned for being low quality money pits. And yet they're attracting, you know, much lower CPMs than Facebook when your ad can appear next to Auntie Doris's rant about emptying the bins. Or even, you know, say LinkedIn, where you can have CPMs of, say, $50, $100. Yes, in terms of that audience, but also your ad could just be sat next to the latest AI slop or some bloke getting up at 4 a.m. to start his work routine. So I think having those trust and quality scores a bit more baked into to media models, going beyond just impressions and actually having, you know, quality scores, trust scores within media and the context it's presented against, I think that can go some way to encouraging brands to fund the news a little bit more alongside, obviously, those UGC platforms.
Yeah, definitely. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, completely preempting some of the stuff we're sort of thinking about here in terms of how we scale it out and how we, you know, attach a better measure of media quality across the board, right? Which obviously, again, direction travel, it's not the brand unique and stuff like that, but it's actually how do we, for clients, actually show up in that space and, you know, you create that credibility, make sure that we are doing that kind of filtering job up front without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Because I think, you know, again, to talk about previous agency, have done some really good work on this as well. As Banks of Cow have done stuff with Ozone, with Newsworks and stuff like that, and have talked about the premium, actually trusting an editorial judgment doesn't inhibit performance, right? So if you're actually trusting those particular main news brands that are kind of sort of fairly broadsheet news brands and some of the bigger brands like, you know, the FT, the Economist, stuff like that, if you're trusting their editorial judgment, then there is no risk attached to targeting news media content, which is a really great thing to be. And we've worked with Ozone Project in the past. We've done some great campaigns with them, and they've worked really well. They're, you know, you see the returns, you see the credibility off the back of it. I think, as Matt sort of rightly says, though, the economics of elsewhere, and in terms of the economics of social platforms, all those kind of different things, is that those low cost and also the ease of accessibility, particularly for what, you know, what makes up a significant portion of Facebook's and Meta's user base is small to medium enterprises, right? So long, relatively what might be called a long tail of advertisers, but actually is a huge boon to the economy and a huge boon to the kind of web thing. And it walks to the kind of thing that Zuckerberg wants to automate out of existence, or in terms of automate agencies out of the existence in servicing those clients. But actually, in terms of those news brands, relative to that, some of those MFA sites, but also being brutally honest about some of those, potentially more of the tabloid mass market end of the market, where the economics is just stuck in this horrible loop, right? It's stuck in this horrible loop of, well, we need to put more content out because people want this and people want ads and people want, and therefore people want to buy ads, and we've got to get content to service those impression buys because the CPM has been pushed down in some kind of trading deal or whatever that might be. And then, because actually where you have got this trust, it's paywalled and it's people that has decision makers, particularly business decision makers, which this research focuses on, they're willing to pay for it, either on the company account or on their account, stuff like that. To deliver the scale to some of the more tabloid parts of the market, they're going to really struggle to sort of scale that, because then given that perception of trust, there's a YouGov study from sort of 2023, which is again one of the ones that illustrates, it's like that actually some of those sites aren't as well trusted or not known as trustworthy, and therefore they're kind of chasing their tail a little bit there. And that ends up, you know, the natural follow for that is like, okay, AI generated stuff like that, content comes through, which then again bruises the credibility. So you go, well, you've not bothered to write that, you've just dumped that and then aggregate some sources and put that out there, sort of thing. That's not to impugn the journalistic practices of the people that are actually doing it, because it's a really difficult job to do it. It's a really difficult one to do at scale. But it's just this kind of horrible loop of economics just being tied down into, we have to do more and more and more because we have to service more and more and more, and the quality starts to just diminish, and that makes it harder to justify. And also then you think about technology solutions in terms of, like, well, actually they're then getting pennies on the pound and a CPM, because that's going through, it's going through an unoptimized supply path, right? So actually all of a sudden they're getting absolutely nothing out of it, and they just keep having to push it more and more out with 50 ad units on a page, slightly exaggerating, but not by much. Which then is not a great environment to get some of that lower hanging fruit, relatively speaking, in the SME market. And it's not necessarily justifying a way to move across.
Yeah, that's definitely a dilemma. And now moving on to our last story for today, which looks at ad agencies taking a stand against fossil fuel advertising. So over 100 UK-based ad agencies representing over 1,000 brands have submitted a joint letter to the government calling for an outright ban on fossil fuel advertising. The letter reads, "Fossil fuel companies are the cigarette companies of the 21st century, using advertising and sponsorship to greenwash their image and sell products that are harmful to human health." Matt, should fossil fuel ads be banned? And are we likely to see laws passed to ban fossil fuel ads? What are your thoughts?
It's a really interesting moral debate. And obviously the debate that the parliamentarians had is now listed online, and it's a really interesting read because there are so many nuances to it. And, you know, ultimately fossil fuel use and production is legal. You know, it's kind of sits in that same category as gambling, same as drinking, same as going to, you know, your favorite burger restaurant for a big old burger. And, you know, outright banning the promotion of those companies and their products, while they're still legally accepted and still obviously hugely important in empowering the country, it's, you know, in terms of outright banning, it may be a step too far. I think, though, there does need to be much more stricter rules and punishments around greenwashing. You know, you can't say outright, you know, we're building for a better tomorrow if, you know, still 90% and over, 95% and over of your total energy production is still fossil fuel based. And, you know, building on that as well, I think in terms of event sponsorship, there may need to be more restrictions around what you can sponsor. For example, sponsoring a clean energy forum if you're a fossil fuel producing company, I think that needs to be pared back on. And kind of wider to that point, I think you do need greater support for advertising standards bodies in order to investigate and properly punish ads which violate those stricter standards. But yes, it's a tightrope walk essentially that has to be walked. But yeah, I do think greater restrictions need to be put in. But yeah, outright banning of fossil fuel, I think at this stage of the game may be too far.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I definitely agree with your stance on greenwashing, that should be taken a lot more seriously. Chris, what are your thoughts?
I'm more of an unequivocal yes on the first part of the question in terms of banning, although still to the degree of equivocation, because it's like, you go, well, actually, Octopus Energy, for example, someone that is trading in that, but also then encouraging the use of renewable energies. But it's like, I where we are right now, right, is extraordinarily urgent. It's beyond urgent need to reduce that fossil fuel consumption, right? Whether that is going to be a double page spread in a particular news title is going to reduce that, I don't know, because obviously they've already got the influences in lobbies, they're sponsoring COPs, they're sponsoring energy conferences, like you say, Matt. They're completely ingrained in this system because the energy transformation system is still fueled by fossil fuels. And beyond the point of urgency, right, tracking towards a 2 degree centimeter, 2C temperature rise versus pre-industrial revolution, which already means everything is going to become uninsurable. You're about to hear the insurance industry going absolutely bananas on it. How has it become unlivable? Place become unlivable? There is all manner of social order effects that come from that. And that's just what we see in the kind of Western world, right? It's already happening in the global south, right? So it's the kind of thing that actually there is an urgent need, and actually is banning fossil fuels one step. The Director General of the UN has said, yeah, absolutely, we need to stop doing this. It's kind of coming from there. While I appreciate there is kind of a nuance, there is something that is within our gift as an industry to start kind of rejecting and pushing back on a little bit. We are very responsible for what we can kind of put out into the world and how what we work for. And I think, Matt, you're absolutely right to kind of point out the nuance of there are things that are value neutral, value dubious, value positive sort of thing. And I don't see any instance where fossil fuels are anything other than value dubious, right? Or beyond kind of value dubious in that respect. Like, I also completely, actually kind of reject the premise that kind of network agencies kind of put out there, any agency group, I mean, including any agency group that I have worked for, might work for, whatever, in the future, past, present, whatever, that can say that will have the influence on companies like British Petroleum, where it's literally in the name, or Shell, Saudi Aramco, whatever. They'll go, well, actually, no, we're encouraging them to do something better. We're encouraging them to promote green energy. That is greenwashing, right? That's greenwashing things of a company where they are making billions and billions and billions of pounds in profit from extraction of resources, which is causing irreversible harm to the planet and life on the planet and people and species, all those kind of different things. It's causing that. And if you are being part of it and encouraging it and trying to take the money because it helps meet a quarterly target, there is a complicity in that. And it's not to say there's obviously people might choose to work on that, but there is a complicity in that that I don't think can be avoided. Now, whether legislation is the right answer, whether legislation is going to happen, legislation I don't think will happen. There's too much kind of influence and too much need for that. But, you know, that's one part of their marketing budget. So there's one part of their expectation in terms of what that might be. And it's also a very, very small part of their enterprise, which is still going to be drilling for oil in the North Sea, the Rosebank oil fields, all those kind of different things are still going to be part of their agenda. And that's the thing they're going to push towards, being like, we need this for a livable future. Like, we need to stop or at least taper down the use of fossil fuels for a livable future. Otherwise, in 30 years, 40 years' time, we're not going to be having this conversation because there's not going to be anything that exists. You can't sell stuff on a dead planet, is the extreme case.
Yeah, definitely. It's an interesting debate because, yeah, like you said, Matt, it's legal. But yeah, Chris, like you said, the damage is absolutely, you know, irreversible at this point. It's causing so much damage. And even, you know, they compared it to, the advertisers compared it to the cigarette industry, the smoking industry. But it's actually even much more harmful than that. So, yeah. And just linking back to the last story now, what can be done to support publishers if ad revenue from fossil fuel companies is lost? Matt, what do you think?
So I think as Ella Britton pointed out on the podcast last week, I think consistency around those rules you have in place, that's, you know, a key and critical point, because that helps advertisers obviously adjust their budgets and publishers plan for where they're getting their revenue in. I think if, you know, fossil fuel advertising restrictions were to be brought into law, I think also that's, you know, the point where if you have the government actually saying, right, if it's outright bad enough to ban the advertising for, maybe there should be greater taxation on these companies, and therefore you can give greater financial incentive for publishers, advertisers, whoever, to transition towards net zero. And then obviously, you know, that direct funding in terms of obviously helping them transition to a cleaner energy portfolio can do some bit to mitigate the losses from those companies. But in terms of, yeah, obviously some publishers more than most will have those deeper relationships with the fossil fuel companies. But I think, you know, we do live in a capitalist society. There's more than enough companies and more than enough sectors to sponsor publishers, even if that fossil fuel revenue was to be lost. So yeah, I think it's a case of having those consistencies around the rules if it were to be brought in, potentially greater financial incentives. But ultimately, you know, if you were to lose, say, a BP or a Shell from the front cover of the Financial Times, there's going to be companies out there that'll still want to be featured against those brands, as we covered in the last story. So yeah, I wouldn't necessarily see it as a doom and gloom scenario for those publishers.
Yeah, there should be many other publishers wanting to take their place. Chris, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, for a start, obviously the net zero economy is growing at 10% compared to less than 1% in the remainder of the economy. So it's exactly to Matt's point, like there's loads of companies that will take their place, and there is a huge emergent, you know, cycle of that. Loads of really interesting climate tech companies, loads of kind of brands that are then working in that space to actually develop, you know, might be like full circular propositions but stuff like that, but actually who are looking to, you know, to operate in that space. And, you know, I would very much love to have those conversations with those brands to actually kind of help them develop and grow. So please, if you're hearing this, do come our way, right? But in terms of the reality on the ground, right, there obviously will be kind of mitigation. There will be kind of things that we revenue that comes from alternative sources, alternative brands. But I think also some of the stuff that feel one net zero can feel a bit pointy headed. And you can see Farage and Richard Tyson, all those kind of people in the Tories pointing in that direction and going, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. Obviously, they've got plenty of it in their own portfolio, and we've probably all got it in our pension fund somewhere. But actually, what if you feel it's quite pointy headed on the ground? And actually, there is actually a serious need to kind of think about what that transition looks like for people on the ground. Like, most people are concerned about their energy bills going up. And I think the government right now, as we're talking about it in terms of energy security, like, for example, transition to wind, there maybe might be things that kind of happen there. Maybe that's something that can potentially be encouraged, because then actually, if we're then talking about and using the language around brands that can help with that transition, for example, certainly from the fund range, the FT, The Economist, New Statesman, Spectator, all those kind of different things. Maybe that's directionally something that might fit in there. But obviously the reality of the ground is, you know, people want food on the table, people want food security, they want energy security. Even describing that is quite pointy headed, but essentially they're worried about the cost there. What can we do to kind of transition that? So going to Matthias' points around levies kind of towards publishing and stuff like that, how can that then be used to support, you know, making things cheaper for every day and making the transition to a lower carbon economy, which is going to have its costs potentially, it's going to have its drawbacks in terms of abundance, stuff like that. How can that, you know, maybe in the immediate term, how can that be mitigated and how can we kind of make that work a little bit more effectively? And I think there's a whole fascinating economy, fascinating movement, fascinating kind of conversation, particularly in business, where that direction is moving, and it's really exciting, really interesting to see how that might potentially be brought to the fore to occupy some of that space that Shell, BP, Saudi Aramco, all those kind of different things don't need as much of, or shouldn't need as much of, or maybe don't have the space for, or won't have the space for.
Yeah, definitely. We want to see those next steps there. But I think that's a good point to wrap up the discussion. Thanks so much, Chris, for joining us. It was great to have you as a guest.
Thanks for having me on.
And thanks, Matt, as always.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks, Chris. Yeah, really enjoyed this one. Really good conversation.
Yeah, great discussion. And thanks to all our listeners. That was today's Mad Tech Podcast.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.